This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today we're going to talk about how to find joy in your relationship with money. And did you know that money is one of the biggest wedges in the bliss wheel of life, but we don't always feel blissful about it? So today we're going to find out how to rethink your relationship with money with the author of a wonderful new book called, and I love the title, The Power of Enough. And in it, financial advisor Elizabeth Husserl offers a groundbreaking blueprint that replaces chasing financial success with cultivating a life of meaning, balance, fulfillment, happiness, joy, bliss, all the good stuff. Before we meet our illustrious guest, let me tell you a little bit more about her. Elizabeth Husserl is a registered investment advisor representative, a financial advisor, and co-founder of Peak 360 Wealth Management, a boutique wealth planning firm. She holds a BS in economics from Tulane University and an MA in East-West psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies, where she is also taught as an adjunct professor. Her experience spans nonprofit work through the Americas, and she's a highly sought-after speaker, having led workshops at some major tech companies such as Airbnb, Unity, and Google. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband and daughter. And is it true that your daughter's name is Oaxaca?
No, my daughter's name is Ishelle, and it was inspired from my time in Oaxaca.
And her name is Ishelle. What a beautiful name. Welcome to Finding Your Bliss. And you're helping parlay me to that very first question, which is that early on in your career, Elizabeth, you spent two glorious years living and working in Oaxaca, Mexico, which you write in the book, and I quote, profoundly marked me. Yeah. Even though you were there to teach women about microfinancing and how to start learning about saving and loan cooperatives, but you write the gifts you received from them were far greater. You say that little did the Oaxacans know that with each hug, smile, and gesture offered, quote, I was recalibrating my experience of well-being, happiness, and wealth, leading me to touch a level of joy that filled my cup of gratitude to the brim. What a gorgeous line. Can you tell us about this time in your life, what led you there, and how this experience shaped a big part of your journey with money and with joy in your life?
Yes. Thank you for reading that back to me, Judy. It's always a joy to hear the phrases come back because I wrote them with so much intention and so much power of what shaped my own experience. So what led me to Oaxaca, I had recently graduated from my bachelor in economics. And I remember one of my favorite professors was from Latin America. Her name was Dr. Quispe from Peru. And I remember, so two things were happening. When I was studying economics, they were framing economics as the allocation of scarce resources. And something just inherently felt off on that description. I was like, wait a second, why are we already pitting this field within scarcity, right? And so I've been sitting with that conversation for 20 plus years. When I remember these classes on Latin American economics with Professor Quispe, she would just naturally bring so much joy to the topic. I'm like, something feels different in her teachings. So I just knew before I was going to go get, you know, my dad wanted me to go get a big job at the World Bank. I was like, I want to take a step back and go explore a different application of wealth and economics by working in a local nonprofit. And so I did my due diligence. I wanted to work with a nonprofit that was locally based, not US based somewhere else. I wanted to, what was a local organization? I ended up in this amazing nonprofit in Oaxaca doing the savings and loan cooperatives with women. And over the 2 years I was there, Judy, what started to transform was this feeling of like, even though I was brought into these villages to teach something, and by all means, I taught a very practical, tangible structure, the experience of the village felt different.
Wow.
Even though there was what we would call material poverty, there was wealth in so many other aspects. And so I started having this side conversation with participants and village members around, what is wealth to you? And the responses I kept getting was, wealth is our communal relationships. It's our relationship to spirit. It's our relationship with nature. It's the way that we throw festivals and ritual together. It's our health. So I started to be like, huh, they're defining wealth in a very different way than what I was taught when I was going through my economics major. And so it started to shape this, I didn't know at the time, right? I was in my mid-20s, but that there was a different perspective of how we defined wealth, and more importantly, how we experience it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I intentionally put that subtitle, right, of finding joy in our relationship to money. Yes. Because to your point, that's not what people normally connect our relationship to money to. But I was able to viscerally experience it there. And I would say for them, it wasn't so much a relationship to money. They found joy in their relationship to the material world because they described the material world wider and differently and more holistically. And again, I don't know if they would be able to articulate those words. That was my experience of being in relationship with them for 2 years. Yeah. And so I knew that my work wasn't there. My work was back in the States or in more contemporary modern cultures where we had so much and yet so many people feel poor. And I was like, what is that about? So that's what marked that exploration.
That's fantastic. So this concept of the power of enough, and again, I'm so glad that you said the full title, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money. Like, that's what just attracted me when I saw your book. Can you tell us more about your brainchild, how this book came together? Obviously, you've studied and you've worked, and then you went into the trenches and saw a whole other view of what wealth really is all about and how it aligns with, you know, all the different kinds of wealth, and mostly about finding joy in your relationship with money. Like, that's a concept most people don't feel. They feel anxious, awkward about money. They don't want to talk about it. They're struggling with it. They don't have enough. They have too much and are worried about losing it. They don't. There's so much emotion and disarray around that word. So you just imbuing it with this new way, new eyes is so heartening and hopeful. Can you tell us how this book evolved? The power of enough, finding joy in your relationship with money.
Well, I think you name a really important catch 22, Judy. We feel terrible if we have too little of it. We feel stressed if we have too much. It's almost like you can't win, right? And so when I came back from Oaxaca and I started my journey more into, okay, what is this about? And so I started my journey. I got both my degree in psychology, but I also went into working as a financial advisor because I wanted to get into the trenches. What does financial advising look like? What is cash flow planning, retirement planning, investment management, all the things that have to do with money? And so I'm like, okay, money, I'm going to take a PhD in learning about you, right? Equally, I got my master's in psychology because I want to learn about humans. And what started to become really apparent is by defining wealth in a narrow vision of wealth is my monetary assets that I accumulate, we were causing undue stress because the reality is there is always someone who's going to have more. Even if you're in the top 1%, there is probably someone who's even higher than you. And so we get stuck in this rat race where it doesn't feel good to talk about money because we're in this comparative game and we're stuck in this comparative game. And we associate net worth with self-worth, right? And so what I came in to do is to be like, okay, how do we start to piece apart what really pertains to the world of money and what does not? Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of the techniques and tools that I talk about in the book and the journey that I help readers go through is let's create some spaciousness of what do we need to learn about organizing our money life. That is important. We do need to know what's coming in, what's going out. Financial literacy is widely important. And let me also take responsibility. That's the key word. Let me take responsibility for my emotions and feelings and beliefs and patterns and behaviors around money because I can have agency on bringing awareness to them so I can start to shift them. I can see what's working and highlight that sense of fulfillment, and I can see what's not working and learn how to digest and release them. So that's the key component that in any relationship, like it makes sense when I tell people, do you have a responsibility in your marriage or in your relationship to your kids? And everyone's like, yes, I have to you know, decide how I show up, how I communicate. Is it quality time? Is it rush time? And the same thing is true in our relationship to money. We have a responsibility to really look at how we show up, so, because it's a two-way street. Then I can talk more about that, but I'll pause for a second because I just share a lot.
I know we can be stuck around money. I have so much I want to talk to you about. But when you sat down to write this book, was it something that you just were like, okay, I can write this book in a week. I have so much inside of me that just is ready to come out. Or was it a struggle? Like, what did it look like?
Judy, I've been writing this book for 10 years.
Wow.
So I think that's the first thing I would say. I've been writing this book for 10 years because I have felt that there's a missing voice in my industry. My industry is predominantly male, right? And it's done a certain way. And I was like, wait a second, why aren't we asking what is enough? At least here in the States, we have the Securities Exchange Commission. I'm like, why are we saying investments are securities? And so I was just like, are we listening to how we talk about this? Mm-hmm. And so for 10 years, I've done a deep dive into my own relationship to money, my passions about this, my clients' relationships to money. And so I've been writing it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've written this book. And then at the start of the pandemic, I had a really dear friend pass. It wasn't because of COVID. She died because of cancer. She was my age. And it was a big wake-up call that you just do not know how long you have.
Yeah.
And it was a moment, just a moment where I'm like, oh my gosh, if I'm going to write this book, it has to happen now. And so I think the turning point was actually hiring a writing coach who helped me go to the finish line and have a coherent arc, because I always felt passionate that I had something to say. I just needed someone to help me organize it so that I can take people on a journey and not just bombard them with all these ideas that I have. So it's been a process. It's been a process.
I may want to talk to you after the show, because I'm in the process of writing a book about finding your bliss that's also been ongoing for 10 years, and I might need a writing coach
to get to the finish line. So much good resource I've learned probably the hard way, but yes, happy to share.
That's amazing. That good for you.
Yeah,
there's something you say in the book that I can't stop thinking about, because I think it's so poignant and so well said, so evocative, and that is fullness versus feeling satisfied. You eat a meal. Yeah. And you're too full and you feel sick.
Yeah.
And satisfaction, where you stop in the middle of the meal and you say, you know what? I'm good. I feel good right now. I can pause.
Yeah.
How does this all relate to money?
Oh my gosh. You asked me this earlier and I didn't answer. So I'm going to tie it into the response to this question is, what is the power of enough? Right. So the power of enough, in my conception of it, it's the embodied experiences, right? Embodying the experience of satiation that come when we digest and integrate, or digest and release those moments that bring meaning to our lives, regardless of our external circumstances. So all of that is a mouthful, but what I want to say about it is that, you know, we've learned this in the last couple of decades with the importance of meditation and mindfulness. When we stop to take moments of presence, right, then we can recognize the things we're grateful for. We can recognize opportunities. What is working in my life? What do I have? That is very much connected to that sense of enoughness, right? The power of enough, that I have enough resources and relationships and connections and creativity. Some of those resources may be finite, right? We have 24 hours, although I talked to my husband's a philosopher. He's like, oh, time expands. So we can have that conversation. Some resources like creativity are not finite. We can have ample, unlimited resources of creativity. And so I think part of it is taking the awareness to truly digest and compound. And I talk about this in chapter one. We know the power of compounding interest in our investment accounts, right? Where interest creates more interest and we have growth. The same thing happens when you start to bring awareness to digesting and compounding moments of meaning. We create meaning dividends where those moments of meaning start to grow on each other, and you start to recognize what are those strategies that work in your life to create fulfillment. And then we start to be aware of the quality. The easiest example, to your point around nutrition, is that we know what it feels like when we consume empty calories. Right? You eat a meal on the rush. You didn't think about it. And you're like, oh, I kind of ate something that was lunch, but I don't remember what I ate. It doesn't feel good. Versus when you sit down and you have a meal and you really are taking in every bite, you feel differently. And so that's the key piece here. Wealth is not something just to accumulate on your assets balance sheet. Wealth is something to embody and experience. Mm-hmm. And we can practice that every day.
That's wonderful. That's so, so fantastic. You've divided this book into three parts. Part one, you embark on a journey, as you write, to fundamentally redefine your understanding of wealth and money. You even take a look at the nature of money itself and introduce the powerful practice of sitting down and having a conversation with money. I've never heard of that before. So cool. And you write that from this foundation, you'll begin the journey towards reclaiming your role as the architect of your financial story. How do you have a conversation with money? What does that look like?
Judy, a conversation with money, it's one of my all-time favorite practices. And so it really is, I mean, it's simple. It's a simple gestalt chair exercise, which is a therapeutic practice where literally it means you're in one chair, you pick a money object. It can be your wallet, a checkbook. You know, younger generations pick up their phones and look at their apps. But you pick a money object and you put that in the chair in front of you, right? I tell people, notice what distance. Do you want to have a tight conversation because you're feeling intimate? Clients who like push, but like I need a little bit of space. So just that's always the fun thing. Notice how far, what space you need. And then I tell people, put a timer on your phone, 5 minutes. And for 5 minutes, literally, it's like you got to go to therapy with money and you get to express what's on your chest. Don't tell money your stories, but tell money like, oh, money, I'm frustrated with you. You're not showing up. Or like, money, I don't know what's happening. Every time you come into my life, you go out really fast. Or like, oh my gosh, money, you just came in a huge capacity and I feel overwhelmed. It could be anything, but what's the feeling that you're having with money? And give yourself 5 minutes of uninterrupted, non-judgmental vent. Just say what's on your chest, right? Literally as if you had gone to therapy with money. When the timer goes off, this is important, Judy, trust that what got needed to say got said. Stop. Finish your sentence, literally change chairs, get up from your chair, hold your money object in your lap. Money now gets 5 minutes. Money gets to respond to you.
Wow.
And respond to what just got said. If that's a stretch, you can say the parts of you that pay checks or that pay taxes, like you're having kind of a parts dialogue, the part of you that's in charge of money, speaking to the part of you that is feeling an emotion around money.
Right.
Then you do it one more time. I like that people like for each role to have two chances because then that's what makes it a conversation. It's not just like a rant or a vent
not
or
a monologue. Yes.
Exactly. Then after all that said and done, take a minute, close your eyes, come back to a mindful moment and be like, what's the takeaway? It's less about analyzing what got said, but what do I feel after that exchange? Do I feel some relief? Because, oh my gosh, money and I are actually on the same page. Do I feel some clarity? Because money's kind of reflected back some things I need to look into because it's my responsibility. Do I feel even more triggered? Because I realize I'm not angry to money. I'm angry at this person who did this thing to me. Sometimes I'm like, people get angry at their parents or they get angry at a colleague, a coworker, et cetera. Like, what's the core? And what I find is that this very simple, profound practice helps you get to the core of what is at the issue at your relationship to money.
Nice.
And if you can't do it in a speaking capacity, a lot of people find it useful to journal. Journal it out.
I was going to say you could write it. If you feel like awkward, or you're not comfortable doing the role play, you could actually journal it. That's so
exactly.
Cool.
So use the timer, journal it. I've had people do it in the car. They're kind of driving. I've had people do it when they're swimming laps at the pool. One way, one lap, it's them talking. The other way, it's money. So you can get as creative as you want.
You could go on a walk and on the way to your destination, you could be the one role. And then on the way back, you could be the money.
Exactly. And in the book, I give a couple examples. I talk about my first relationship to money where I'm just like, I mean, money basically told me, Elizabeth, you're holding on too tight. and I give some other client examples. So it's also good to see how it plays out.
That's fabulous. I also love, Elizabeth, these mini moments in your book. They're so great. And you ask a lot of questions in these mini moments. And one of them is, do I feel truly wealthy in my life? Have I ever felt wealthy? If so, in what ways? Are money and wealth the same thing or are they different?
They're very different. And let me speak really quick to the mini moments, why they have a role, and then I'll speak their difference. Okay. I wrote these mini moments on purpose because we do not talk enough about money in our culture, right? Money is a taboo. We don't like saying how much we make, how much we earn, how much we spend. So these mini moments, I mean, if we put them together, there are probably 30 different questions that I asked throughout the book, are meant to give you a way to talk to people about money and wealth in relationship to it in a way that doesn't require you talking about numbers, because I really want to encourage people to talk more about money. and the relationship to it. So that's just, I want to kind of point that out. That's really important. I really want more people to feel comfortable and have very specific questions and doorways in. So money and wealth, they're very different things. Money is a social technology. I talk about that in the book. It is a technology mm-hmm. that we use for exchange, right? Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's exchange for things that are potentially different values, goods and services. We use it to store value. We use it to purchase future things. We use it to create credit. And so it has a very technological component to it, but it allows us to be in social relationships with each other when we do exchange, right? What's mm-hmm. really important to notice is that back in the day when we lived in smaller villages or in smaller communities where yes. we knew each other, money and trust were different, right? Mm-hmm. Where we were mm-hmm. using money for exchange of goods and services, and people trusted you based on what they knew about you. In our yes. modern cultures, we don't know each other as intimately. So sometimes money will replace trust, our mm-hmm. creditworthiness, our, you know, I'm trusting that if you're giving me money, it means that you're going to pay for whatever exchange or that we have going on. And that's been tricky because money sometimes gets too connected to our definition, our sense of worth, our sense of value. Yeah. So by defining money as a social technology, I create a little bit of spaciousness that does not speak to how trustworthy you are as a person. And it's really your intimate yeah. relationships that will reflect that back. Wealth mm-hmm. is connected to the root of the word wealth is well-being. And so wealth is that accumulation of experiences that enhance a sense of well-being in your life. So notice yeah. how much wider that definition is. It is yeah. not the accumulation of material resources. It is the accumulation of meaningful experiences that enhance well-being. And so that's why in the second part of the book, and maybe we'll go into it, I talk about the wealth mandala. So I give people a really concrete, I love simple one-page PDFs, right? I'm a mom. Yes. I'm like simplicity, consistency to the point. And in that wealth mandala, it's like, how do we start to truly start to envision wealth differently, not just yes. conceptually, but really practically?
No, I'm excited to get to that. I'm excited to get to that soon because that was another thing that just really, really resonated. But I also keep thinking about this saying, there's millionaires and there's yeah. millionaire people, yeah. to your point, right? I'd rather be a millionaire person than be a millionaire, right? Because that
speak to that, Judy. What does that mean to you?
Well, millionaires and millionaire people. Millionaires just have a lot of money. They have yeah. millions.
Yeah.
But a millionaire person is somebody that has fulfillment,
yeah.
gratitude, joy,
yeah.
peace of mind. They're good to people. They show yeah. generosity of spirit. They may not make very much money. They may yeah. not make any money at all. A millionaire person was Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
She didn't have anything, but she gave all of it.
And probably right? received so much too. I mean, I just got chills when you said that, because I think if we start to think about what are the units that make up that millionaire life, that millionaire person, it's not just dollar bills that a person who's only financially millionaire has, but they're units of meaning. So if Mother Teresa, right, she probably had so many social relationships. She had so many meaningful encounters and exchanges with people, so many hugs, so many smiles, so many acts of kindness. And that starts to build a different wealth in her social account, personal account, kindness account, however you want to define it.
Makes me emotional when you say this,
because
I think that's so much more important. And a lot of people don't get that.
Judy, everything that I put in the book, I get it in myself. Like, I lived, you know, for many years of my life, my choice of living structure was communal, right? And so I would share these beautiful homes in the Berkeley Hills or Bay Area Hills with other adults, and we would do communal living. And I'll never forget the day we all got a Vitamix. I'm like, oh my God, I felt so wealthy. We had this amazing Vitamix to do amazing nutritional things with. And we would share it. Like, we didn't need 8 Vitamixes. We needed one because we just yes. took turns using it. And then I remember I was in grad school finishing my master's, and I went to go get a car loan, and the bank said, no, you don't qualify. What do you mean I don't qualify? I feel so wealthy. And it was one of those moments I'm like, oh my gosh, my internal experience isn't being mapped by what the bank reads on a statement. Why? Right? And I'm wow. like, okay, and I get it. That's what they're reading, because we haven't created other asset sheets that show the other ways that I feel wealthy and da, 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 da. And I had enough of my own embodied wealth to kind of flow with it and be like, okay, so what does the bank need for me to go then qualify for a loan? And what do I need to work towards that? But it did not chip away at my sense of self-worth. And I think that's the key difference.
That's so wonderful. Oh, I love it. You talk about abundance and scarcity. You know, we talked about the fullness and the satisfaction. In Buddhist philosophy, you write that there's a poignant allegory of the hungry ghost. I love this. And these beings have insatiable appetites of hoarding, consuming. No matter how much, I know people like this, no matter how much they consume, they're never satisfied. Yeah. How is a life of embodied wealth different from that? And how can we require less to feel more?
Don't answer that just yet. We'll be right back with financial advisor Elizabeth Hesterle after this short break. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, FM 96.7. And just before the break, I was asking you, Elizabeth, how we can learn to become satisfied and require less to feel more.
So it goes back to the difference between unconscious consumption and mindful consumption, right? I think that's the key component here. And so let's tie it all together. So when I talk about the abundance scarcity loop that we're stuck in, I'm going to use my hands, right? Imagine one hand is pushing scarcity away, because that's what we want to do. We want to push scarcity away and we want to grasp onto this idea of abundance to do it. And so notice, my body is tense in both capacities when I'm doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm pushing something away and I'm grasping onto it because I want more, 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 more. I'm thinking that is the solution. And so notice when I'm doing that, it's almost like I'm not paying attention to what I'm consuming because all my attention and resources are either pushing away or grasping. It's a very tense somatic expression. But if I then put my arms down for a moment, I'm like, okay, let me work with what I actually have right now, here and now, the power of experiencing enough with what I have. And let me start to practice satiation, feeling fulfilled with my resources. And that doesn't mean that I don't practice design and agency and shifting things. I'm not saying that our lives are perfect at all and that we can easily find our way to an experience enough, but it does require looking at what are the resources you have available, right? And sometimes that means going to your cash flow, saying what's coming in, what's going out, what do I have discretionary? I don't care if your discretionary income is $20 a month. That is still $20 you have to work with, right? And then you can take that into your needs mandala and start to be like, what are some of the needs that I want to bring more awareness and fulfillment to? And how do I use those $20 to do that? And how do I also come up with non-monetary strategies to do it and practice satiating and feeling fulfilled in that experience? Going back to the hungry ghost, it's almost like instead of having this broken loop where what comes in just like oozes out, it's almost like I have my hands at the base of my body where you start to kind of build this container where you can start to accumulate those moments of meaning and have them compound and grow inside of you. When you continue to consume things and you decide which ones you digest and integrate versus which ones get released, you can build on those and literally create kind of dividends that build and give you that sense of satiation and fulfillment. So it's a different way of consumption. Because here's a really important part, Judy. Consumption isn't good or bad. It's neutral, right? We have to drink water to stay alive. We have to consume calories to stay alive. It is a neutral act. But we have discernment and we have the power to design how we consume and what we consume. And it's quality over quantity. And you get to decide what brings you quality.
Really, really fascinating. I also love, and I didn't mention this at the top, and I really want to tell this to the listeners, that at the end of each chapter, you have these takeaways. They're so helpful.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of information. So the takeaways reinforce what you've just learned in the chapter. And in fact, one of my favorite ones was in chapter one, when you write just the idea of the power of enough and how wealth is not about having everything, but finding meaning in everything we have. What a powerful line. I just want that to almost sink in for people. Wealth is not about having everything, but finding meaning in everything we have. Can you say more about that?
Yes. And it's like, as soon as you say that, my gaze goes up and I look around my room, all the things that we've collected over the years, are you engaging with them, mm-hmm. right? Or are they collecting dust? Mm-hmm. It's really about finding meaning in those material objects that you have chosen or have been gifted to you or you have purchased that are now in your life, and making sure you're finding meaning in them. There's a great quote by this Buddhist monk, David Loy, and he says, we're not materialistic enough. And everyone's like, feathers get ruffled. You're like, what do you mean by that, right?
What?
And exactly. And then what he says is that we're not materialistic enough because we're so obsessed with money, the symbol of the material world, that we don't step through and participate with the material world. So let's go back to what we were saying, is that literally take time when you're listening to this to just like raise your gaze, look around your home environment and see, what are you really engaging with? You might have the most comfortable couch that at the end of the day, you go and you lounge and you just like cuddle up with this amazing pillow and blanket. I mean, that is very much what I do. That is something you're engaging with. And then you might have something that, oh my gosh, I haven't used that in years. So why do you have it? And I think it's that invitation to really be in conscious awareness, participation, exchange with what you create in your environment, and to feel the agency and the courage to let go of what no longer is serving you, because guess what? It's going to be someone else's prized possession. So really being in that consciousness of, you have the ability to create fulfillment with what you already have.
Already have. I love that. I know that mandala is a Sanskrit word that means circle. So what is a wealth mandala? What is it? And why do you recommend that we draw one and we use this in our lives?
It comes back to that subtitle, right? Of how do we find joy in all of this? They use the mandala as a path from suffering to joy. So I chose that intentionally because, to your point, Judy, we opened this podcast talking about our relationship to money and wealth is where a lot of people find anxiety, suffering, overwhelm, all that fun stuff. And so if we were to truly transform it to joy, I took a lot of the work that people have done around human needs, right? Maslow is one. There's another economist from Chile, Manfred Max Neef. What I love about their work is that they simplified and say, human needs are universal. We all have human needs. So let's just throw out the window this idea that we're needy or not needy. We have human needs. How we satisfy our needs is personal. And that's the key component. And so what I did with the wealth mandala is that I gave a very clear framework where we can define wealth more broadly, more holistically. And it's wealth as we experience it in our body center, in our heart center, in our mind center, in our financial stability center. And so each of these different centers have three human needs that are consistent. And there's a little bit of space for, if you have a need that is burning that I didn't name, by all means, write it in. And how you use the wealth mandala, I use it every year with clients instead of New Year's resolutions. We start the year by the wealth mandala. We take it out. I have clients color in, right? Each of these different areas: belonging, participation, connection, purpose, understanding, safety, financial stability. And on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is you color it all the way to the brim and it's beautifully colored all in. Mm. And 1 is, I'm really feeling a sense of lack and perhaps poverty in this area. And that's an edgy thing to say, but it's almost like saying we have different ways of experiencing poverty. First and foremost, you color it in a non-judgmental way. And then I tell people, put it up on the wall in front of you. And I first want you to take in the beauty of your life, because every single flower, if you were to sit down and just be in meditative contemplation of it, every single flower is its own petals. No two petals are alike. No two petals are fully formed. It's this beautiful kind of like artwork of organic emerging. Let yourself have that expression of just being with what is there. And then I tell people, come to the areas that you feel more fulfilled with and see what is working. What strategies am I currently employing in those areas that I have found work in my life? Great. Note it. What are those kind of like quality? For example, I'm super relational. So I use a lot of relationship strategies in my different needs. My husband's not. He is very conceptual. He loves ideas and learning. So he brings that type of strategy to his needs. Then you go to, I tell people every year, choose two needs that you want to focus on. Potentially it's a need that's fulfilled and you want to strengthen, or potentially it's a need that you're feeling lack that you want to bring awareness and attention to. And your mandala can very quickly identify what those are. So it's a very easy framework to be like, yep, that's it. That's where I'm feeling a sense of lack in my life. And then I tell people, and I'll end with this, Judy, is I tell people to write down monetary strategies and non-monetary strategies. This is key to break our dependency on money and our ability to often scapegoat money to solve our problems. We have to have super clear, what are the ways that I'm going to address this need that have nothing to do with money? And that's where I start to take responsibility for designing change in my life.
I love that. I don't know why I keep picturing this this necklace that's a wealth mandala that you could wear.
Yeah.
And that could be like a physical reminder of what's good, what's not good, and what you have to remind yourself to do or not do.
Totally. Or even as you said that, like I come from my mom's Catholic, like her rosary beads, right? And each bead could be a little need. And you just kind of go through your needs on a daily basis to be like, how fulfilled am I feeling? How do we develop our ways to be human?
You know what I'm going to send you? I have something called the Bliss Bracelet. I don't know if you can see that.
Oh, yeah.
And each one of those little Swarovski crystals all represent a wedge in the wheel of life. So one has to do with money, one with relationships, one with health and fitness, one with your spiritual feelings about your spiritual world.
I would love that.
So it's a reminder. I'm going to send you one, Judy.
Yeah.
Because that might inspire you to do the necklace. That could be really cool. You also have this wonderful list, Elizabeth, of resources for inspiration on how to transform needs into satisfiers. And I want you to explain what satisfiers are. But there's words like ability, faith, devotion, creativity, optimism, joy, freedom, gratitude, generosity. And you ask the reader these questions: what strengths and capacities do I naturally possess? And how can I use some of the resources I naturally have to help build what I feel weakest in? Can you tell us more about this list? Because I found it so inspirational, and how we can use it to transform the needs into the satisfiers. What did you mean by this?
I'll start by saying kind of a bigger statement. The power of enough for me is a human birthright that everyone has access to. And when I made that list, we are all born with some natural capabilities and capacities and aptitudes. And so think of it as a list of aptitudes. And sometimes we don't give ourselves credit for what we're good at, right? We're so hard on ourselves. And so that was a list that, you know, I would love people to just print out and circle your top five aptitudes and capacities. And if all you do is write that on a sticky note and put it on your mirror and see it every day, great. That's a step in the right direction. But the next step is like, okay, so this is my aptitude. This is what I naturally do well. Then you go to the different needs. Okay, how do I bring these natural aptitudes into addressing these needs, right? And so maybe I have a natural aptitude for kindness. I tend to be kind to people, right? And so I'm working on my need for connection. Maybe my strategy is that every day I'm going to pay one compliment, non-monetary. And that is what I'm committing to this year. And that's just going to help me foster a sense of connection. And so maybe I'm shy and that's hard, but I can commit to that. And so that's how we start to kind of cross over what you're naturally good at with how you fulfill your needs. And then the types of satisfier, what I speak to there is that some satisfiers are very singular, right? I do one thing and it really fulfills one need. Some are synergetic, right? And so let's go back to that example that I'm going to pay a compliment forward every day. I'm doing it to really fortify my need for connection. But guess what? Over a week, I start to feel like I belong in my neighborhood more. People are waving at me when I'm walking my dog. And you're like, huh, synergetic satisfier. It started to fulfill two needs. And so ultimately, over time, the more we have those synergetic satisfiers, the more easeful and effortless this becomes. I'm all about ease and effort. So find those synergetic satisfiers that are touching multiple needs at once. And be aware of those satisfiers that potentially can be violating, where you think they're helping one need, but they're actually also taking away. And so an easy one is retail therapy.
So, so true. One of my favorite parts of your book, there's so many, Elizabeth, is purpose. When you talk about purpose, this is my thing that I live for and I talk about and write about, and how to embody purpose in your life. What are some of your top suggestions on how to achieve this?
Oh, I just got chills. I've gotten chills this whole conversation, but here in particular, Judy, the way that I hold purpose is sometimes it's really hard to know what your purpose is. That is a big question that we ask ourselves. And so I tell people one of the easiest ways to start to develop a relationship with purpose is through participation. And what I mean by that is that if you start to pay attention to what are those natural places that you like to participate in your life, it could be participation through work, through conversations, through volunteering, through community. When you start to pay attention, where do you naturally participate? And then you start to do kind of an assessment of like, huh, what are the common threads there? You start to find out about your purpose. And so I tell people, if you're stuck and you don't know what your purpose is, start by participating in those things that naturally draw and attract you, because it will reveal really important nuggets about your purpose.
That's fantastic. I love that. You also talk about creativity and that it's the spark that ignites us to innovate and invent. What are some strategies for how to embark on more creativity in our lives?
Before you answer that, we're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and financial advisor Elizabeth Hasserl when we come back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And just before the break, I was asking you, Elizabeth, how we can learn to feel more satisfied and require less to feel more.
I think a lot of creativity comes from those down moments, right? And so I'm a planner, right? I do it for a living. It's naturally wired in who I am. And I've had to learn how to kind of time block empty time or wandering time or time where I don't have to know what I'm going to be doing, because it's in those quiet down moments when we're off that a lot of the creative juices start to flow. And so I think sometimes we can't force creativity, but we can create spaces for it to emerge.
I always feel that great happiness is aligned with being in service to others. We talked about Mother Teresa. That's what makes me cry when I think about that. What is the benefit and how can we integrate more acts of service into our daily lives?
I think to what we were talking about before with purpose and participation, an act of service, I mean, think of it as like you've removed by spirit or life of the universe, whatever your word is, to do something, right? It's because you're following the threads of your heart to participate. And again, when you start to just allow your heart, and this is a really important piece that I talk about in the book, is that we tend to think about money and wealth from a mind center. We're analyzing, we're planning. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is like, no, our bodies have a lot of input and wisdom when it comes to wealth. Our hearts have a lot of input and wisdom when it comes to wealth. So acts of kindness and acts of service is a very heart-centered strategy that gives us so much wisdom and insight in our wealth mandala.
Yes.
So I'm not saying do it just to get something back, but it's something that should naturally move you, and then take the moment to get the insight of, huh, what is being revealed to me in my acts of service?
Well, here, when you were in this wonderful village for 2 years teaching all the women, and you were obviously doing an act of service, you were serving people, teaching them, but what you got back in addition to you giving this wonderful service, you got back all these wonderful gifts that you had never expected.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Everything, I think, is about transcendence. That's why I love yoga. I love meditation. So we can transcend the everyday and problems and worries and how to move beyond the confines of it, just being yourself. You write beautifully about this. What are some of the strategies for embodying transcendence?
That's a great one. And I'm married to a philosopher and a spiritual seeker. So we have this conversation often, Judy, which I really appreciate. You know, and I think we have different approaches. You know, my husband is more non-dual and it's transcendence above, right, any dual expression of things. My transcendence is actually very rooted in the material world. And so I think for me, and this is why I wrote the book, is that if I can transcend the barrier that money has had in my relationship to money and in our collective relationship to money so that I can have a direct experience of engagement with the material world, I have transcended an interference to my ability to experience and embody wealth. So it's a different movement. And I think, and I wrote this, it's like, I laugh with people or I joke with people and say, I get to have such intimate conversations with people who potentially aren't going to see therapists, but they're coming to me to talk about money. And we go to those deep, vulnerable places of what money represents. And there's a transcendence there, right? Of really doing that deep digging into that connection with soul. For my purpose of transcendence is being able to touch my soul. For someone else, you could define it differently. Wow. And so we spend too much time and resources scapegoating money as an everyday anxiety. And if we're able to create that right relationship with it, it's no longer an interference. It's no longer a scapegoat. And it no longer stands in that direct relationship that I have with soul.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. In part three of the book, you guide people towards more abundance and fulfillment, and you help people gain tools to discover the wisdom of all of your money stories, your financial DNA, and the power of unconditional acceptance. I would love to unpack this a little. Can you speak about what your money story is, how to rewrite it, and connect to it so it becomes a source of power, not of pain?
I would say, generally speaking, what a person's money story is truly all those experiences that we've had since our first memory with money. And I'd like to tell people, Judy, there's a free exercise on my website that you can download today to write that your money story. I know for me, my experience of doing my money story was exactly what inspired me to write this book. I mean, so many things inspired me, but it was my money story and working through two big themes in my story, which was scarcity that was passed down through my paternal lineage, right? My grandfather was an Austrian Jew who had to escape the Second World War and ended up in South America, Colombia, without a word of Spanish and $50 in his pocket. And so really having to deal with that scarcity that he didn't necessarily integrate, right? Because it got passed on somatically to my dad, got passed on somatically to me. And I made a commitment that I was not going to pass it on to my daughter. So much of my own journey with scarcity has come through not just my story, but the financial DNA, which I also talk in about the book, which is our lineage. And the other story was around belonging, right? And, you know, my parents were from Latin America, South America, Colombia, and I was raised in the States and trying to figure out my sense of belonging. So, you know, and how both of those things have influenced the decisions I've made around money, belonging, and scarcity. And it's so enlightening when we sit down and start to make those connections. And what I like to tell people, Judy, is that when you write your money story, write it out as much as you can in one fell swoop, then step away from it, literally for a week. Come back to it when it's less fresh. And I like to tell people, read it as if it were your best friend's story, right? And so read it with that lens of compassion and kindness, of like the kindness we would give to our best friend. And from that place, start to see what connections you make. And it changes everything because we're often so judgmental. But if you read it as if it were your best friend saying, hey, help me, we're very different in our approach.
Or you could even say, you know, pretend it's a small child. You would take that small child. You could even be the small child in yourself. You would take that small child by the hand and you would be so kind and gentle. You wouldn't be abrasive. You wouldn't be harsh about it, right? Which you might be with yourself.
Exactly. Like what did they need to hear in that moment?
There's so much in the book. You talk about body awareness and embodied meditation just briefly, because I'm a big meditation person. Can you speak more about body awareness and embodied meditation and how that can help you with all of this?
One of the practices in the book is I ask people to literally swallow when they have a moment of meaning. And that may sound strange, but once you start to do it, it starts to like build, right? You're like, and no one actually can notice. So for example, Judy, right? This conversation today will make my list of feeling satiated. I love meaningful conversations. And so after every meaningful conversation, I will pause before I go on to my next round of emails. I will swallow and I will let my body really integrate and know what that felt like. Because the more I build that somatic practice of fulfillment, the faster it is for me to go back there when I'm not there, right? I can go through then a bout of anxiety or disappointment. And I'm like, okay, I got to be with that. But I know my way back to meaning and fulfillment because I've taught my body what that feels like.
That's amazing. That's like exercising that mental muscle, right?
Yep.
So you're exercising that actual sensation and adding it to your toolkit of this is where I go to when I need help.
And it's a somatic muscle in conversation with a mental muscle.
Nice, nice, nice. What if someone is in deep financial struggle?
Yeah.
And is making mistake after mistake after mistake, but they can't be objective because they're so in it. They cannot see the forest from the trees.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for a person like that?
Yeah. So I would say two things because this is very much a reality for a lot of people. And so thank you for asking it. I would say first, find a space for you to have a conversation with money because you really need to give yourself the gift of expressing the emotions you're feeling. It can be overwhelm, it can be anxiety, and to do it in a way that you're not fixing it. So give yourself the opportunity to just express what you're feeling because it's real and it's valid. And you're the first person who has to be able to recognize that. Second, I would say put the numbers aside for a second because when you're in so much financial distress, math feels really hard and we can't make things work. Put that aside, and it may feel superfluous, but I would encourage people to go to the Wealth Mandala and to do the exercise of recognizing what are the areas that potentially they're feeling a little bit more fulfilled than the financial stability area. They may feel like a zero because the financial stability is on fire, right? And that's real. But take a minute to go assess the rest of your life and to see, are there any other of your human needs that are feeling a little bit more fulfilled? And if so, what are the strategies that are working there? And what starts to happen, Judy, is that when you start to kind of lift the gaze, because it's almost like the deer in headlights, like, oh my God, my head goes into the sand because I'm overwhelmed. How do we help you lift the gaze so that you can feel a little bit more spaciousness and support? And those qualities that we were talking about, that list of qualities and aptitudes, how are they playing out in other areas of your life so that you can potentially start to see, okay, are there new opportunities, possibilities, connections, anything new that I haven't seen that I can now bring to my spreadsheets so I have a sense of a little more spaciousness and a little bit more possibility. And that's what I would tell someone is, you know, use other techniques to create a sense of possibility when maybe it doesn't feel like you have any.
Amazing. Thank you. Why is it so uncomfortable to talk openly about money with friends?
Because
whether we're struggling with it or happy with it or wherever we're at with it, how do we change this social taboo?
I mean, we talked about it briefly before, but it's this idea where money is so, we let money define us and we let money define our sense of self-worth and our sense of value. And funny enough, that's kind of how we talk about it in my industry. We talk about net worth. And so I consciously make an effort when I'm talking to clients to not say net worth. When I'm talking about their assets, I say asset size, because I'm aware with my degree in psychology that if I continue to say those words, net worth, they're hearing self-worth, right? And so I think a part of it is that, so again, using some of the mini moments that I give in the book to be able to have different conversations with our loved ones around money is really important, our relationship to it, right? We don't have to talk about the numbers. We can put the asset size conversation aside for a minute, but that doesn't mean that we can't talk about our experience of wealth, our experience of money, our successes, our failures, our fears, because the reality is they're a lot more common than we think. I mean, so much of what I do, Judy, I normalize our relationship to money with clients. People go, oh, I feel so much relief. And so think of the collective relief we could be building if we had these conversations more often.
More often. How can we view money as a companion and as a guide rather than the gatekeeper to our freedom?
you start talking to it, right? You start having a relationship to it. And so for me at this point, Judy, money's a little spirit helper that sits on my shoulder and is often kind of chattering at different client meetings. And it's because I have spent years literally sitting down. So every morning when I'm letting my cup of tea brew, I will sit down and check in with money. And right now, at this point in my life, they're quick check-ins, much like a quick check with my husband. How'd you sleep last night, right? But when you start to have a relationship with it, it might be too soon to stretch it into being a guy, but at least start with it being a friend. And how do you build friendships? You call them, you talk to them, you spend quality time with them. Because what ends up happening is that money is almost like the white elephant in the room, and we're in arranged marriage, and we never sit down and talk to it. And so you can start to change that today.
That's really fabulous. Wow. If someone were to start their journey towards financial healing and satiation right now after this show, what would be your single most important piece of advice?
Oh my God, there's so many. My single most important piece of advice is close the show and know that you are in relationship with money. And I would say this, no one, no financial advisor, no CPA, no investment expert, no one should stand in between you and your relationship to money. It's like having a third person in a marriage. It doesn't necessarily work unless that's your thing, right? Exactly. Which could totally be. But even if it's your thing, I hope you have direct relationships with each person you're married to. Truly, if there's one thing I want you to chew on and swallow and consume is that you have a direct relationship to money, much like you have a direct relationship to spirit. Same thing. And you can start to build that today. And there's so many tools and techniques in the book. There's free resources on my website. There's even listening to this podcast, you can start to work on your relationship to money today. And if that means you take out your wallet, you look at it and you say, hello, that's a start.
That's a start. And I know this is going to sound like the same question, but I'm going to ask you also, what is one of your favorite golden nuggets that you love in the book that you go to and go, wow, I'm glad I wrote about that?
Oh, I just, again, got chills when you said that. One of my favorite nuggets is in chapter 5, where I really claim publicly, I love my life, right? That's like a sub theme to this book, is that I have found a way to say, I love my life. And I'm not saying that I wake up every day with that sentiment, but it happens frequently enough that when I don't wake up with that sentiment, I know how to get back there. And so, you know, and I'm still working. I'm not financially independent in the traditional. I'm not retired. I love my life because I'm in this dynamic relationship with wealth, money, resources, people, my purpose. Mm-hmm. And I will never retire from that.
What is bliss for Elizabeth Husserl?
Oh my gosh. Dancing Zumba, having meaningful conversations, you know, laughing with my teenage daughter. But I think it's really having meaningful connection. That's what brings me bliss.
Lovely. Well, I want to thank you for connecting with us today. That has brought us bliss. And what is the best way for people to contact you, connect with you on social media, and of course, to get a copy of this beautiful book, The Power of Enough, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money?
Thank you, Judy. So the book is wherever you buy your favorite books, Amazon, bookshop.org. You can also go to my website, elizabethhusserl.com. I have links to purchase the book there, but I also have a lot of free resources and practices from the book that you can start to practice today. And then I'm on Instagram, #ElizabethHusserl, and I put podcasts and tidbits and stories. So by all means, follow me there. I'd love to connect and be in conversation. So thank you, Judy, for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Each week, we spot a fabulous person like Elizabeth Husserl. And I want to spell that for you so you can see her website. And her last name is H-U-S-S-E-R-L. So we spotlight fabulous people like Elizabeth who are living their bliss. So if you're a person like that, an author, artist, a meditation or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you. Also, what did you love about today's show? Are there any guests or topics you'd like us to feature on Finding Your Bliss? Just write to us at fyb@findingyourbliss.com. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the Bliss Coach. That means I help you find your bliss and connect to your passion and purpose. And I'm also on Insight Timer, the #1 free meditation app. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook.
I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Elizabeth Husserl, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Giuliani Annunziello, Benjamin Thomas, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrach, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.